You're listening to Investigation Insiders by Integris Intelligence.
Hello again, everyone. This is Farhad. Welcome to another episode of Investigation Insiders. We are recording this episode with about a week or so left in Ramadan. While it's been a fantastic month, I'm glad that it's coming to an end. I just wanted to mention that because I'm sure this month has been interesting for our staff as well, dealing with me not eating and drinking. So thank you, everyone, for supporting me. And in fact, a couple of my colleagues did a partial fast with me. So that's really greatly appreciated. So with that being said, we have another fantastic guest today, the founder of the Sakura Group, Scott Wilcox. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing good, Farhad. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolutely. So am I. So you all have heard me speak about how organizations like Integris rely on partners throughout the world to deliver our services. And that's kind of how Scott and I met a few years ago. A mutual friend, Patrick Kane, who was a previous podcast guest as well, introduced us a couple of years ago when we had a need in the Middle East. And, you know, Scott and I have stayed in touch ever since. Scott, would you mind providing our audience with sort of a high-level overview of your background?
Sure. Well, I'm an entrepreneur with British-Irish roots. I formed Sakura Group in 2005, concurrent to my what was supposed to be coming downtime and out from the Royal Marines, but that went sideways. I've been based between Dubai and DC since 2007.
Ah, I got you. And so you grew up in the UK?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the UK in a small fishing town just outside of London. And followed in my father's footsteps, entering commando training at the age of 16. After that, I served for 11 years and saw a niche as licensing and standardization was coming in both the UK and overseas with the SIA. So at that point, demobilized, retrained as an executive protection agent, and was lucky enough to find someone to help mentor me as I made that transition.
You know, mentors are an interesting part of just, I know we have had many. Are you still in touch with that individual?
Not with him, although I have had several over the years for different stages of my own growth in business and different iterations of what the company was doing. So I think bringing in the expertise, the right expertise at the right time, to learn from is really crucial.
Sure. So you mentioned, you sort of alluded to it already about getting into the business. Talk about, like, how does that all occur? How do you form a company? How do you start, you know, doing business? How do you find customers? How did that all work initially? Because again, you were in the military and you kind of transitioned into this. So how does that work?
Yeah, sure. So at the start, as with every journey, Farhad, and I know you've been there as well, it's extremely tough. There's no one banging on your door, so you have to put pride aside. It starts a bit of a scattergun approach, going out, speaking to as many people as I could, and, you know, trying to just bring in something in terms of revenue or an opportunity so I can get it onto my company CV. So particularly having that, you know, the military background, we all talk a great game, but when it comes down to it, none of us really have a clue, or my cohort at least, about running or developing business. And that's why, you know, at that time I sought out a mentor. I didn't really know that's what I was looking for, but somebody who had already done it, who was willing to share their experiences. And it's that point, I think, if you know, a wise man learns from, a good man learns from his mistakes, a wise man learns from the mistakes of others. And I think a combination of the two have led me to where I am now.
That's fantastic. I mean, I know the company was started in the UK, And you know, one of the specialties that your company offers is mitigating risks in the UAE. Can you talk about the connection and expertise related to the UAE?
Yeah. So coming from the UK to the UAE is a relatively easy transition. It's not like the one that I had here as an example, where you've got to go through an extensive visa process and vetting and so on and so forth, and years in, and I'm still going through that in part. So again, going into the UAE with a military mindset, that ethic of work hard, play hard, it will certainly set you up right. And on top of that, Dubai is a great place for entrepreneurs. In fact, it's better now than it was then. I didn't really know that at the time, but I certainly do now. So look, I'd heard and read a lot about the UAE. I had family there. I knew about its historical ties to the UK, its welcoming culture, and it being both an investment hub and a gateway to other high or higher opportunities in the Middle East and Africa. So literally the day that I left the military, I headed straight there.
Wow. And how long ago was it?
17 years ago, 2000, 2007.
That's interesting. That's right about the time that myself and my partner actually started our first business, by the way. So your headquarters is now Dubai, right? Like, you look at, TV and publications and everything else, and Dubai seems like one of the best places on earth, right? Can you tell us about it? Maybe you have a story or two that you can share which demonstrate what Dubai is like and whether it meets what we perceive from the outside looking in.
Sure. Yeah. Again, it's been 17 years now. It really is a great place. Although I've had my ups and downs there with wanting to expand or to take a step away from the pace that is sometimes being very close and hands-on to the business, I thought maybe a proper step back would be the right thing at some point. But honestly, I've never found a place quite like it where I enjoy living. Other places are fantastic to go on holiday or to come and take a break, which is a lot of the time what I do here in the States. I come and spend time with my sons, but for work and for living, the UAE is fantastic. Sure, rents are high. It's hot as hell in summer, and that's usually when I try and get out. And then inevitably, with all the marketing, it's also drawn some less desirable characters with more nefarious intent, primarily around financial crime, scamming,
Sure.
that kind of thing. But on the whole, it's an extremely safe place to live and raise kids. A great hub to operate from. That airport is literally second to none. And it's stable. People respect the police far. The government does a great job in maintaining harmony among the population. You got what could be the biggest culture clash on the planet is just about the most peaceful and prosperous culmination of humans. I love it. Even when there's other regions with a lot of turmoil.
Sure. No, that I mean that's really interesting to hear. And actually, that's sort of like the inspiration for today's show. So, as you know, just like you mentioned, there's now a lot of businesses from and individuals that are either doing business in, or investing in or partnering with people from the UAE here in the US and vice versa. We wanted to talk a little bit about navigating risk in the UAE. So, maybe we could start with an overview of what the United Arab Emirates is.
So the UAE is made up of seven states, which we call emirates, Abu Dhabi being the largest one and the capital, and Dubai being the second and probably the most popular outside, given the amount of marketing and Instagram and TikTok exposure that it gets. But Abu Dhabi is the seat of power, very much like DC here. And if you compare Dubai and New York, you wouldn't be far off. Dubai is like New York. Abu Dhabi is certainly more like Washington, D.C., in terms of it being the seat of government and the seat of power. We have a huge expat community. 88% is the estimated breakdown of the population today. And yeah, what can I tell you? Fantastic tourism, great place to invest. It's very easy to set up and do business, providing you know the rules, right?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because it definitely feels like the region is commercializing a lot more. Obviously, the Middle East in general has been known for the oil and gas industry, but it feels like, well, it's been for a long time now, but it's commercializing a lot more, which is leading to all the things that you're talking about. So what's important to know about risk in the region?
Yeah, I mean, okay, from a compliance standpoint, we've had the introduction of VAT a few years ago and now corporation tax. So looking at the entrepreneurs coming in and those setting up new businesses, it's something that the country itself is still navigating, okay? It's harder right now today to get good advice because that advice is sitting only in a few organizations. And you haven't spent more from it. It's not as ubiquitous as it would have been to an easy to set up and be compliant 2 or 3 years ago. So starting with that, I think that is an on-message concern for those that are setting up. Risk more holistically, or risk more towards our side of house, the UAE is unwaveringly stable from a geopolitical perspective. It's been through the regional conflicts, Iraq, Afghanistan, what's going on with in Gaza right now. And again, from that point of view, or Yemen, crikey, is relatively unscathed and is a strong proponent of for peace throughout the region. The economy is changeable and benefits and aches from what goes on around it. Case in point, there's been the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which has seen a huge influx of expats from both countries. Mm-hmm. They're seeking the same things: stability, work, and a place to invest. The wider region, which when you look at it for us, Nigeria left, India right, and throughout Africa and up into the Sands, opens a whole new conversation of risk, which does ripple into the region. As many of these countries and their business leaders use the UAE again as a stable hub, home for families, home for their money for sure, and of course a place to invest.
Sure. So, like, a lot of our listeners are like U.S. based companies or individuals within U.S. based companies. What do you think? What do you think? And I think you've sort of alluded to it already. But what should U.S. companies be most concerned about from a safety and security perspective?
But when you're talking region wide, we're in the most volatile region. You look at the coups throughout Africa over the last few years, particularly in Franco Africa. You have again, Israel, Gaza, and there are several other conflicts throughout the continent, and even on the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. The staff count in the UAE for US multinationals is never particularly high, particularly among expatriates. It's a hub, okay, for them to spoke out into other areas, and again, for the reasons I've already mentioned, is why it's a great place to be based from. I believe there are two points that are really important for US companies to get right when they're looking at the region. Firstly, is their contingency planning. We regularly review contingency plans or continuity plans, business recovery plans for organizations with interest throughout the region. And invariably, they're lacking. The compliance element is drawn from things or laws and legislation that may stack up really well in the US, but don't transfer very well into the region. So they're not realistic in how they're going to be able to be exercised. And what we also see a lot is a lack of re-entry strategy. So the point of, if we evacuate, or if we have to cease business operations, what are our triggers for re-entry? How are we going to move people? To whom does our duty of care extend? Is it to family members? Do those family members have visas to be able to enter safe locations, and so on and so forth? So that's one of the biggest issues, I think. And the second one really is more around risk perception. A lot of US companies and UK and EU companies, they appoint regional expatriates as their senior management in country, and they have a very different risk appetite to what the corporation may have back in the States. So with that, you often get a skewed view or a skewed report, because the risk perception of someone, say, from Lebanon about what may be going around them would be very different from someone, an expatriate from Newark, New Jersey, as to what's going on. And they will have, again, a different understanding of what home office may expect. Does that answer it?
That's an interesting point. If I could just interrupt. So how do you bridge that gap? I think that can be said of like regions throughout the world. But what's the best way of bridging that gap?
Yeah, I think again communication is key. And again, having these triggers and scenarios put out. I spoke at an OSAC recently. And it was about, again, contingency planning, and in part on this subject, and saying that, you know, these exercises seem to always be run in-house. They never bring in their responders or their vendors and learn from the experience of the vendors who, you know, whilst they may be dealing with one crisis, the vendor may be dealing with 9 or 10 simultaneously. Sure. So you know, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. So again, running scenarios, real scenarios, and giving real responses and input to the business, again through that two-way communication, I think is vital to getting it right.
Very, very interesting. And again, that's the way they should be thinking about mitigating risk, right? Is in a proactive way where, like you're saying, take real life situations and really work your way through it and determine how you're going to react with it. So that's very helpful points. So are you able to share a case study demonstrating the dangers of being ill prepared in the UAE, and then perhaps one that shows, you know, the benefits of being prepared?
Sure. Yeah, again, it comes down to expectation and understanding that the profiles that you may operate with or protocols you may operate to in home country don't transfer well to the region or the UAE as a whole. We're often asked to provide armed escorts, as an example. That is now something you can legally do in the UAE. There is a process, but it's extremely thorough process that could take a lot of time. So again, planning and preparation is a key consideration to take in place into mind when visiting, if that's going to be the type of profile. And again, you know, it's the thing of trying to when coming en masse, understanding the UAE is a small nation. The resources are finite. The resources of manpower, the amount of, although we have many, many beautiful vehicles, again, good drivers and things like that. So it's more a case actually of leaving too short of time and having the expectation that everything's going to be just like home when it isn't. That would be the danger of the ill preparation. Moving on, really more to the thing of being well prepared. You know, we were heavily involved in COP 29 last year, and we brought in clients from literally all over the world at obviously a peak time. So again, going into that resourcing and being able to provide the armed escorts and the armored vehicles and so on and so forth, but the point of that, Farhad, is that event took place in November. We started reserving assets and having conversations with national security, with the COP20 organizers, the UNDSS, way back in March. So again, sorry if I'm almost repeating myself here, but time to prepare is the key for both of those.
Well, I mean, that's really interesting, because I think that I think that even some of our clients, I think that, you know, they assume that, you know, things can, like, if you could pay, things could get done. And from what I'm hearing from what you're saying is, and that's true of a lot of things, but that's not necessarily the case, right? Just, I think the finite resources, again, you got to plan, and you got to get approval to do all the things that clients request of you. So I think that's a really, really helpful point, because I'm not sure that people realize that. Even in some of the conversations that we've had, you know, it's like, hey, we got this thing going on wherever. Can you guys support that? The answer is not yes. The answer is possibly, depending on the amount of time and what you need, correct?
Sure, no, absolutely. Look, like I said, the UAE and the security apparatus and those who operate in it, they are absolutely without ego. They're extremely professional, and they're extremely forward-leaning. They want to accommodate. And, you know, they're very proud of what they've achieved and continue to achieve day in, day out. You know, like I said, they will assist and accommodate, but it takes time.
So, you know, like, I imagine that there are companies that probably will circumvent or try to circumvent the process that's in place, right? And just to accommodate their clients or for the revenue or whatever the case is, right? So, you know, the client maybe doesn't care about that. They just want the job done, right? I presume that there's probably some risks associated with operating with a partner like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, the UAE has now introduced additional licensing for the protective services. Not only do some of the protocols and laws not translate well, some of the words don't translate well either. So from English to Arabic. So, you know, for a long time, there were companies operating within the gap, so to speak. And that gap has now been closed out. CIRA, the Security Industry Regulatory Agency, run by a gentleman called Colonel Majid on the day-to-day. Again, great guy, extremely accommodating, and listens to industry, which is fantastic. CIRA's introduced licensing now specifically for executive protection, and the agents now, your EP agents, must also be licensed. And there's no circumventing with I'm a guide, I am an assistant, I'm so on and so forth. You know, the UAE apparatus, like I said, is onto it.
Sure. No, that's very helpful. We actually had a client. Now we didn't work with them. They kind of told us about this after the fact, that they just had a bunch of their executives travel to Dubai for a conference of sorts, and they had to set up, you know, drivers, and I'm not sure if they were armed or unarmed, but, you know, all those kind of things. But he actually said the thing that proved to be most useful was that they had ambulances set up to address anyone with medical needs or, you know, just dehydration or whatever the case is. And that's what they ended up utilizing the most. So I imagine those things come into play as well in the things that you guys are doing regularly, right?
Yeah, sure. Again, COP28 was a good example of this, of, you know, the proximity to the major healthcare infrastructure. You're quite a way out at the expo center, but again, right, the plan, they did a great job of putting not just medical facilities in, but actually having roaming medics around the site as well, proactively looking for signs, handing out water, and advising some of the stand owners, again, about cooling, ventilation, and so on. So again, that was really proactive. They learned a lot of lessons, I'm sure, although I wasn't part of it during the expo, to make sure that site is both safe. And again, you know, if you're traveling in, you've been on a 13, 14-hour flight from the States, you are going to be dehydrated on top of that. You're going to be in a hot conference center. Yeah, having medics or at least those with the ability to administer first aid is key for sure.
Yeah, again, your point about, you know, like things always not translating well, whether it's by language or just by practice or policy, right? I mean, that alone is something, you know, again, maybe we take for granted here in the U.S. because there are a lot of healthcare facilities usually pretty close to whatever it is that's going on. So just things like that, I think are interesting and shows that, you know, you have to deal with the situation that you're in, not the one you want to be in, right?
Yeah. The compliance thing for that is one of the biggest hurdles for marrying up U.S. headquarter expectation and regional security provider reality. Right. I can't tell you how many times I sit in meetings and even the regional guy is cringing when he starts to talk about things. And no one's saying they're not important, but you're being graded against a standard that where we operate doesn't exist and can't be enforced or implemented. And, you know, I could dig into this, you know, at any time, but it really is both a bugbear and a rub.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's this. We actually reconnected just recently and scheduled this podcast with that, you know, document that you guys created about travel risk and, you know, the fallacy of like, a subscription-based sort of plan. I mean, this is the same kind of thing. It's educating the marketplace, which I imagine, you know, is probably one of the most difficult tasks that you have because, you know, part of the issue is you don't know what the next guys are saying, right? And so they may wittingly or unwittingly be saying the wrong thing, but you still have to compete against that, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, it is very tough trying to compete. Look, I said in that paper, and I wrote another one in the last few days that I released, which again is a follow-on, and there'll be more from it. But the decisions for travel risk management and overseas protection are made here in the States, and they're made and driven not necessarily by security personnel or safety personnel, but by HR. Who are a big stakeholder, IT, who are a huge stakeholder in the integration of the systems, and then legal and finance. And it comes down to, you know, I sit in these presentations, what I get asked, things like, you know, well, can we talk about cyber resilience policy? And can you talk about the integration of PNR? Details and can you give us an insight on how you manage HIPAA data and the California Privacy Act and so on and so forth. But when the rubber meets the road, what I am actually tested on and what nobody ever asks is how quickly can you get our people out of Lebanon? Can you talk me through the process of doing collapsing our offices and moving our people safely out of Cairo? And what it would look like to get them back in. What do you think is, you know, our steps back to business recovery, and so on? We never asked that. Sure. But like I said, those are the things that we actually contribute to on the day. And you know, like I said, I scratched my head.
So that's actually I think a good segue into maybe concluding here with, you know, recommendations that you would have for those either considering doing business, traveling to the region, interacting with people. You know, the one other thing that actually we didn't talk about, which I'd like to actually bring up before we conclude, is like due diligence work, right? I find that due diligence work in the region, a lot of people, you know, don't do it and they end up like you mentioned earlier, like fraud schemes, right? Like are something that happens over there. And it, you know, everybody you speak to knows everything and everybody and is wired and can get the information you need and all that sort of stuff. But it seems like, all right, how do you get through who's telling you the truth and who's not, right? Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, if for anyone that's either looking to partner or do business with, how do you go about like doing the appropriate due diligence in the region?
Okay, so due diligence in the region is largely paid lip service to. The standard the standard in the marketplace compared to back in say London or in the States is miles and miles apart. It's done very badly, if at all. A lot of things are still done on a handshake or a guy knows a guy knows a guy, and trust is built, or relative trust is built that way. Things move too fast, okay, and without the right checks and balances in place. And that's why you see so many foreigners, let's just say, but American businessmen, British businessmen, French, whatever, the European, they're getting scammed. And it's because they're not doing the correct, they're look, getting. Creating a an atmosphere or a perception of wealth in the UAE is extremely low cost. And oftentimes visitors come in, they want to spend, they want to make money, they want to partner. And entertaining somebody for a few days into a scam, into an elaborate scam, is very easy to do. You don't have to look too far on open media to see some of the elaborate scams that have involved crime syndicates fronting up in excess of $1 million to take advantage of those looking to put a plot down in the UAE. How do you go around it? Well, again, it can start even with open source. Look at this, look at the MOs that are in play of those scams. Having companies like and advisors like yourselves that know who to speak to and where to go to unravel and to try to, I think, best appease the client by asking them just to slow down a little and take things one step at a time and not proceeding until you're satisfied that you've got all the relevant data.
I think that that's a huge thing. So, I think that that's but from our perspective here, right? I mean, that's one of the, I think the biggest risks is just making sure that who you're dealing with and the entities that you're dealing with are not sort of a front for something that's gonna end up hurting yourselves or your organization. So again, with that being said, what I was going to lead into earlier was what recommendations, high level recommendations do you have for those considering doing business in the region to kind of close out the episode?
Yeah, sure. Going back to that due diligence point at the start, it's really important and it's key. Making sure as well it's third order. So you're not just doing due diligence in the UAE and on the person and the assets they have there. You should be doing them in their home country. Don't forget, I said that the expat run rate at the moment in the UAE is 88%. So you may find yourself having to do additional due diligence out into other countries throughout the region or back home. And that's really, really key. Do your homework, familiarize yourself with the local laws and regulations, particularly now around both VAT and corporation tax and ensuring that you have the right structure and licensing before you come. Be culturally aware. As you said at the beginning, it's Ramadan right now. Look at the implications on of all sorts of things, right the way from your staff hours, staff productivity, and leave coverage during the holy month and how it extends into the two big holidays thereafter. And again, look, build strong relationships. Take your time. Consider partnering with those that are already in the market. You can do soft landings in, and you can timeline those businesses at the front end, knowing that it could be that you're only a partner or whatever else, or embedded for a year or two whilst the company establishes itself, or do you do it for a limited scope so you're not necessarily tied in. But it allows you to test the water in the region without taking on too much risk and to benefit from the infrastructure that other companies have already built.
Sure. Now, that's fantastic advice. And I think, you know, for those listening, that I'd really pay attention to everything that Scott just said, and frankly, reach out to him if you have any questions. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. I'm glad we finally got this off the ground. I think this is a region and an area that, you know, again, is known but unknown. And I think some of the things that you said today helped to kind of demystify that. And so, and thank you everyone for listening and tuning in and following us and commenting and liking and all that, all the support. It's been fantastic. Till next time, Scott, thanks again.
Thank you.
Don't forget to follow us. We are on LinkedIn and Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.